Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
There's a myth a lot of us grow up believing that hair loss is just a part of life. It happens. It runs in the family. And once it starts, there's no stopping it. But here's the truth. That's outdated thinking. Scientific understanding of hair loss has advanced in recent years. Today, we have a deeper knowledge of underlying causes, and we've developed science-backed solutions that are both effective and safe. And that's at the very root of Happy Head. Dermatologist-led innovation offering stronger, FDA-approved ingredients that work. But what really sets Happy Head apart is how personalized it is. They don't do one-size-fits-all fixes. You fill out a comprehensive consultation, and their board-certified dermatologists assign a formula specifically for your hair loss pattern, goals, and lifestyle. And whether you're early in your journey or more advanced, Happy Head offers targeted options that actually work. Topical treatments, oral capsules, or potent dual-action bundles all delivered directly to you, discreetly and freshly compounded in the U.S. Most people start seeing results in 3 to 6 months. But the real magic? It's sustainable. This isn't just about growing hair, it's about keeping it long-term. So no, hair loss isn't inevitable anymore. Visit happyhead.com and find out what's possible when science, expertise, and personalization come together. Hair happiness starts here.
On the morning of March 24th, 1994, 26-year-old Matthew Flores, a former Army lieutenant and Gulf War veteran, parked his rented car outside his new workplace in Santa Clara, California. Moments later, he was shot execution style as he leaned into the car to grab his jacket. The parking lot was full of employees starting their day, yet no one saw the shooter. Security footage revealed a dark Ford Explorer circling the lot suspiciously around the time Matt was killed, but unfortunately, his murder was not captured on camera. Despite a thorough investigation, no motive or suspects have been identified publicly. It's been over 30 years since Matt was killed, and investigators are still searching for the killer. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. Okay, Matthew Flores, as you heard from the teaser, this is an interesting case for a couple reasons. One, he was shot in broad daylight, and there appeared to be at least 20 witnesses that could have potentially seen the actual shooting and or the killer. And yet to this day, over 30 years, nobody has come forward. And we're going to dive into why that may be the case, but we're also going to explore some of the theories and potential motives surrounding Matt Flores' death. The other reason I was drawn to this case, as you will see, is there is a Rhode Island connection. Matthew is originally from Rhode Island, I believe East Providence, Rhode Island. And as soon as I started watching some of the archival footage associated with this case, I immediately saw my local news channel covering a story when Matthew originally came home from the Gulf War. He seemed like a great guy from what I can see on the surface, was a new father, and was taken in a very suspicious set of circumstances. And a lot of people are left asking why, including his mother, Ellen, who I saw in another video talking about Matthew's death and how it has affected her and the rest of her family. So yeah, knowing the circumstances around this case, it seems like on the surface, especially after you hear the teaser, you would expect this case to be solved relatively quick, and yet here we are all this time and no answers. And what has been released publicly, it doesn't seem like they're really that close to solving it, which is troubling. So we're going to break it all down. We're going to talk about the case. I'm going to discuss some potential theories as far as why, the motive behind it. And there isn't a really unexpected turn in the story where we may have some insight into why Matthew was killed, or it could be a red herring. But we're going to cover it all. Let's not waste any more time. Let's dive into this week's case. Matthew Donald Flores was born on May 17, 1967, to parents Donald and Ellen. He grew up in East Providence, Rhode Island, where his teachers described him as a kind and popular kid who went out of his way to befriend classmates who were cast out or picked on. After graduating from high school, Matt earned an ROTC scholarship and went to college, where he studied mechanical engineering. 2 months after receiving his degree, Matt married his high school sweetheart, Denise. Friends told the Mercury News that Matt and Denise were the perfect couple, and their wedding was remembered as the wedding of the century. Denise described Matt as loving, generous, and honest. She said he was full of drive and ambition, and he never let anything get him down. After their wedding, Matt enlisted in the Army and began training at an officer's academy. He graduated first in his class and continued his military education as a paratrooper. Once his training was complete, Matt was stationed at Fort Stewart, Georgia, where he served as a platoon leader in the mechanized division, and he was later promoted to first lieutenant. It wasn't long before Matt's unit was deployed for Operation Desert Storm during the Gulf War. When he returned to Fort Stewart after serving with honor, Matt and Denise started a family, and in July of 1993, their only child, Danielle, was born. By early 1994, Matt was ready to leave the Army and pursue his lifelong dream of becoming an engineer. His enlistment was set to end in March of that year, so he began searching for job opportunities. At the same time, Matt was also working on multiple projects with Denise's boss, Dr. Irvin Deloach, a doctor at a plastic surgery office. The two were collaborating on building prototypes for two medical devices, one designed to help drain blood during and after surgery, and another to deliver oxygen during surgery. Matt developed the specifications for the devices while a friend of Dr. Deloach was creating the prototypes. Matt and Deloach signed a contract giving each an equal share in the projects and agreeing that no decisions would be made without the other's consent. Now, unfortunately, neither of these products would ever come to fruition. According to the Mercury News, in February of 1994, Matt received an offer from the tech company Applied Materials to work as a field process engineer. The position included a few months of training in Santa Clara, California, followed by a transfer to the company's Dallas office. The hiring team at Applied Materials later said that they were thoroughly impressed with Matt's can-do attitude, high energy, and what they described as, quote, sincerity and character. Denise later told Unsolved Mysteries that both she and Matt were thrilled about this job opportunity. She said, quote, it was our new start in life as a family, us making decisions instead of the military. This was his dream come true. He finished with the military, he'd done everything right, and now he landed the job of his dreams. In March of 1994, Matt's time in the Army officially came to an end. So shortly after that, he, Denise, and their 8-month-old daughter Danielle temporarily moved to Santa Clara, California. The family settled into a nearby apartment while Matt began his training. On March 24th, at approximately 8:11 a.m., Matt arrived for his second week of training at Applied Materials. He parked his rented, white Chevy Corsica in an unassigned spot in the middle of the parking lot at Building 12, located at 3225 Oakmead Village Drive. Now, right near Matt's car, there was another employee sitting in her car listening to the radio. And just before 8:15 a.m., she heard a gunshot, and when she turned around to see what was going on, she saw Matt's body slump just outside of his car door. However, she did not see the shooter. She then got out of her car, called 911, and covered Matt's head with a jacket. First responders arrived promptly and found that Matt had been shot once in the back of the head from around 1 to 2 feet away. It appeared he was shot while leaning into his car to retrieve his jacket, and according to the Providence Journal, my local paper, the fatal shot was fired from a large caliber handgun using a silver jacketed hollow point round. Detectives were immediately called to the scene to investigate Matt's murder. But it's important to note that Santa Clara wasn't known for homicides averaging only 3 to 4 per year, while some years having none at all. So an execution-style killing outside of a tech company building was highly unusual for them. At the scene, detectives noticed that the shell casing was missing, and there was no sign of struggle or anything to suggest that Matt was aware that the killer was approaching him from behind. It's also important to note that all of his belongings, including his wallet, were left untouched. In addition to finding his wallet, detectives also found his briefcase and a stack of papers lying close to his hand. So that's the timeline that led up to the events and kind of a general overview of the crime scene. But as I mentioned in the teaser, this was in the middle of the day, early morning, with plenty of people in the parking lot. This wasn't in some dark alley in the middle of the night. And yet, investigators show up. They have this person laying on the ground with one gunshot wound to the back of the head, and nobody knows anything. A couple people may have heard the gunshot, but there's no connection, no description of a vehicle, no registration data, no description of the potential person driving the suspect vehicle, nothing. Nothing at all. They just know that they have this guy laying in the middle of the parking lot. He clearly had been shot. And initially, the only real conclusion that you have, just based on what I've told you, is this doesn't appear to be financial in nature. And if you extrapolate that out a little further and you think about the time of day and where this took place and how populated it was, it really leaves you scratching your head because on one hand, it appears to be spontaneous and erratic and almost some signs of desperation where the shooter didn't really care if they were apprehended. But on the other hand, when you think about the one shot to the head, measures being taken to ensure that the shell casing wasn't left behind, this does appear that it could be someone who's a professional. So at this point, all theories are in play. And as I mentioned, Santa Clara is not too familiar with homicide. So I'm sure they're looking at each other going, okay, we got a serious one here. What do we do? And we're going to continue talking about it. We're going to talk about the direction they went as far as the initial investigation and where it is today. But before we do, let's take our first break.
There's a myth a lot of us grow up believing that hair loss is just a part of life. It happens. It runs in the family. Once it starts, there's no stopping it. But here's the truth. That's outdated thinking. Scientific understanding of hair loss has advanced in recent years. Today, we have a deeper knowledge of underlying causes, and we've developed science-backed solutions that are both effective and safe. And that's at the very root of Happy Head. Dermatologist-led innovation offering stronger, FDA-approved ingredients that work. But what really sets Happy Head apart is how personalized it is. They don't do one-size-fits-all fixes. You fill out a comprehensive consultation, and their board-certified dermatologists design a formula specifically for your hair loss pattern, goals, and lifestyle. And whether you're early in your journey or more advanced, Happy Head offers targeted options that actually work. Topical treatments, oral capsules, or potent dual-action bundles all delivered directly to you, discreetly and freshly compounded in the U.S. Most people start seeing results in 3 to 6 months. But the real magic? It's sustainable. This isn't just about growing hair, it's about keeping it long term. So no, hair loss isn't inevitable anymore. Visit happyhead.com and find out what's possible when science, expertise, and personalization come together. Hair happiness starts here.
Okay, so let's get right back into it. Unsolved Mysteries reported that detectives immediately began interviewing potential witnesses. And as I've already mentioned, there were more than 20 people in the parking lot at the time of the shooting, but no one saw the killer. And I know immediately some of you may be saying, okay, this is an inside job. There were people in that parking lot who are intentionally covering this up. And that's possible. But when you also think about the morning and everyone who's so caught up in what they're doing and their responsibilities and what may have happened the night before, if they're not anticipating this happening, it's very easy that they could have missed it. And it happened so quickly that by the time they process what is actually transpiring, it's too late and the suspect and the suspect vehicle are already gone. So although it's frustrating, it is completely possible that although there were 20 people in the parking lot, they weren't in positions to see or hear what was going on. And even for the people that were, by the time they came to the realization, like a murder had just taken place, it's too late and they've already missed the critical information that could have helped solve the case. But they didn't only have potential witnesses in this case because detectives also reviewed footage from several security cameras in the area. However, this was 1994 and the technology was far from advanced. The footage was grainy, black and white, and the cameras were stationary, unable to track or pan like most cameras are able to do today. And to make matters worse, Matt had parked in a blind spot, so the murder itself wasn't captured. And that's always the way it goes. Right when you need that angle, the camera will cut off right before you're able to solve the whole case. And there's a lot of things that can be taken from this, because I made sure to mention this was an unassigned parking spot. So Matt may have parked there before, but there wasn't a guarantee that he was going to park there that day. So when you think about counterintelligence and the preparation going into this murder, there's no way that the suspect could have known, yeah, if we do it right there, it's not going to be picked up by these cameras, because there was no guarantee that's where he was going to be. So I do think that's an important factor. And it does show that if there was any premeditation, which clearly there was some, it wasn't that extensive. And there's only a limited amount of planning they could have done. And this just appears to be a stroke of bad luck. There's no way the suspects would have known that this was going to be the case and the murder itself wouldn't be caught on camera. But despite all of these setbacks, detectives did uncover a critical lead. At 7:52 a.m., a dark Ford Explorer was seen circling the parking lot. It was a two-door sport model manufactured between 1991 and 1994 with distinctive black trim along its lower panels. According to the Mercury News, the footage showed the Explorer crossing the parking lot stall near the driveway entrance, facing directly toward the camera. A white sedan resembling Matt's rental car then appeared in frame, passing behind the Explorer, and moments later, that Explorer pulled out and followed the sedan. The footage then showed the Explorer returning almost immediately, circling the lot a second time before parking in the same stall. A few moments later, Matt's car arrived, and by the next frame, the Explorer was gone. 90 seconds later, Matt was shot. Just 20 seconds after that, the Explorer drove in front of the camera again, but this time heading toward the parking lot exit. So there's a lot to unpack here, and it's human nature when you have a case that has limited information to maybe look too deep into certain pieces of evidence. But with this video, I do think there's a lot that can be taken from it. It also poses some major questions. So first off, you have this vehicle pulling in before Matt arrived, which suggests some familiarity with his schedule, knowing what time he was supposed to arrive. And they also park in the general vicinity of where Matt would be parking. Not the exact location, as we mentioned, he was in an unassigned spot, so there's no guarantee, but they knew the general area. But then you have this curveball where this sedan resembling Matt's vehicle shows up and the Explorer appears to follow it for a couple seconds. And there's a lot you can look into here, and maybe it's all wrong, but on the surface, it looks like they misidentified Matt's vehicle. So what does that tell us? Well, it does show a lack of familiarity not only with Matt's rental car, but maybe a lack of reconnaissance taking place prior to the actual hit. So could this be a professional? Is this someone who did this sporadically? Is this hit something much more surface level and small scale, like a road rage incident that may have taken place that day or a prior day? So there's a lot of angles you can go with here. And as an investigator, you're being pulled in two directions. On one hand, it appears it could be a professional hit. On the other, it looks like it could have been carried out by a novice. And maybe the motive behind the killing, it's not that deep. It could have been something surface level that had evolved and became a thing within a matter of hours or days. So as a detective, we have to step back and you have to go down both paths, and you have to see if there's validity to those theories. And not to get too much ahead here, but based on this video and based on what we have here after this, there's really to this day no definitive answer to that question. Was this carried out by a person or a group of people who have done this before? Or was this someone who had an axe to grind, who was pissed at Matt and decided they were going to kill him? But just to throw one more wrinkle in here, could this almost be a double mistake? And what I mean by that is the Explorer sees this initial sedan and comes to a quick conclusion that it's the wrong vehicle. Then Matt pulls in and they shoot him. But the reality is the first vehicle they saw was actually the intended target, and Matt was the victim of mistaken identity. So heads going all over the place here as I was reading through the research. At this point, I start to come up with some general ideas of what I think. And I can tell you honestly, at this point in the story, all options were still open for me. As you can imagine, detectives worked tirelessly to identify the vehicle, and according to the Mercury News, they worked with multiple agencies, including NASA, to magnify and enhance the images of the Explorer in the hopes of recovering a license plate. They also contacted car dealerships and rental agencies, but despite their efforts, the vehicle was never identified, at least as far as we know. So detectives continued their investigation, distributing thousands of questionnaires to company employees and handing out flyers to people who frequented the area near the parking lot. Applied Materials even offered a $100,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of Matt's killer. When these efforts failed to produce any leads, detectives expanded their investigation, flying to both Rhode Island and Georgia to dig into Matt's past and also interview his friends and family. However, according to the Mercury News, Matt had a clean background, nothing unusual or suspicious ever stood out. Now, detectives also focused on Denise, which was a natural step given that she was Matt's spouse. Over several months, they questioned her repeatedly, and although Denise was never officially named a suspect, it became evident to her that she hadn't been fully cleared either. So, to protect herself, she eventually did hire a lawyer, but despite this, she continued cooperating with police and speaking openly to the media. And I've said this numerous times, lawyering up is not to me a sign of guilt. And the fact that she was still cooperative with police and the media says a lot. She was just seeking legal counsel to make sure that she didn't jam herself up or say anything that could potentially lead to an investigation going down a rabbit hole that wasn't worth exploring. So there's nothing wrong with it. And if you take anything out of what I've just said there, if you ever find yourself in a similar situation where you're being questioned by law enforcement, if they are doing the right thing, it shouldn't raise any flags that you've lawyered up, and it would only benefit you to have someone present to guide you through that process to make sure that you don't make any mistakes that could get you in trouble. Now, another avenue that detectives pursued involved Matt's stepfather, Mike, who was also a former police officer. Mike's background included growing up around people who had mafia connections and a long career in law enforcement, which led detectives to consider whether his past may have indirectly played a role in Matt's murder, maybe through a grudge from someone who he had arrested or unresolved issues with some earlier associations led to Matt's death. However, as far as I can tell, detectives found no evidence linking Mike's history or his career to anything in the case. And although I understand the need to vet this theory, it doesn't seem very plausible to me. To put it bluntly, if you're going to retaliate after all this time, you're going to hit Mike where it hurts. You're not going to go after his stepson who's living in California. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And I also want to point out that during an interview that took place later, Mike denied even being connected to anybody in the mafia and said that growing up in Rhode Island, you do run into some people like this at bars and events, but there was no direct connections. And I can confirm this. Growing up in Rhode Island, I do know of people that I have encountered who have some dark connections. I'm not necessarily friends with them, but I would consider some of them acquaintances where we see each other and there's a, you know, a head nod and that's about it. And Rhode Island is a very small state and there's a joke, you know, everyone knows everyone in Rhode Island, and it's not completely false. Through one connection or another, you can probably find an association with almost everybody in Rhode Island. And that's one of the benefits and the curses of living here. I wouldn't live anywhere else, but what Mike is saying here, it's absolutely true. So after exploring all of these angles, detectives were still left without any solid leads. And at this point, they had examined multiple theories, but none of them really seemed to make sense or fit the puzzle. And when you really think about it, Matt had been in town less than 2 weeks. Not quite enough time to start an affair that may potentially provoke some violence. And a road rage incident also seemed unlikely since Matt wasn't known to have a temper. And the dark Ford Explorer, which police believe was connected to the crime, had been circling the parking lot before Matt even arrived. But as I mentioned, that would line up if the road rage incident happened that day. But what if it happened on a previous day and maybe Matt cut this Ford Explorer off? They didn't engage with them that day, but they followed him to where he worked and decided to come back on the next day. If that's the case, then a road rage incident still could be in play, which is why I don't want to take it completely off the table. And as far as the affair angle, yes, very unlikely, but also not impossible. So with all these dead ends and no real motive rising to the surface, detectives were still left with three strong potential theories: a professional hit, an amateur getting lucky, or perhaps a tragic case of mistaken identity. And from where I'm sitting, even to this day, all three theories are still in play. But let's fast forward in the story, because around 5 months after Matt's murder, the Providence Journal, which I've already stated is the local paper here in Rhode Island, they published a four-part series on the case. And in that series, detectives revealed that they had conducted nearly 1,000 interviews and reviewed 2,500 questionnaires filled out by Applied Materials employees. And despite their efforts, they still had very little physical evidence, no eyewitnesses, no suspects, and no clear motive. One detective went on record saying, quote, "There were 22 people within that parking lot in a position either to hear something or see something. We feel very strongly that somebody did see what happened, and they won't come forward for whatever reason. We are trying to reach that reluctant witness." Well, detective, I can give you a couple reasons why they might not have come forward. First one being they're involved. I don't know how, but somehow they're connected to this case, and they contributed in some way to Matt's death. The other, more likely reason is that they're afraid. Think about what we're looking at here. This is a potential hit. They got to Matt in a parking lot in the middle of the morning, and they got away with it. And you want them to come forward and put their life on the line when you don't even have the person in custody who committed this act. That's a big ask. And by them putting themselves out there, even though you're gonna guarantee them some safety, there's a reality that if their name is leaked or it comes out during trial, that they could be next. And that's a genuine fear, and I completely understand. Now, on the other side of it, as a detective, I would say to that witness, there are measures that can be taken, and there have been many cases where someone who could be in danger after testifying has been protected and was able to go on with their life without any issues. Is that a guarantee? No. And that may be why, if there is someone who has that critical piece of information, they haven't come forward yet. But pause the video or pause the audio real quick. Let me know down in the comments what you would do in this situation. If you did have that critical piece of information and the information was relating to potentially a professional hit, would you come forward? Would you be willing to take that chance? I'm interested to see the outcome here, because I think it's going to be pretty split, but let's hear what you have to say. Now, unfortunately, after the series came out, the investigation slowed down, as did the media coverage. But as I mentioned earlier, in January of 1996, Unsolved Mysteries aired an episode about Matt's murder. And in that episode, detectives reiterated that their strongest lead was still that dark Ford Explorer circling the parking lot prior to Matt's murder. Matt's mother, Ellen, told Unsolved Mysteries that she was still at a loss as to why anyone would want to hurt her son. She said, quote, "He was never involved in anything in terms of drugs, gambling, fooling around, any of the things that you would think would lead to being murdered. Nothing." Denise said the murder continues to haunt her. She explained, quote, "Whoever did this to him, I want them to know what they've taken. One minute life was great, we had everything. And the next minute, it was shattered." Denise also spoke about her and Matt's daughter, who was just 8 months old when Matt was killed. Denise said, quote, "I don't think she remembers him anymore. She was too little. I plan on showing her all the videos that we have so she knows what kind of daddy she had. But she won't know what it feels like for daddy to hug her. I lost everything that day." Okay, so we're going to fast forward a little bit in the timeline, because we're talking about coverage over 30 years. So that brings us to March of 1996, 2 years after Matt's murder. And at that time, detectives provided an update to the Mercury News stating that the tips had largely dried up. However, they were working with the FBI to comb through registration forms from every hotel in the country, focusing on anyone who had registered a Ford Explorer. They also continued to review surveillance footage for additional clues. At that time, Denise also shared that she had gone over every aspect of their lives, trying to figure out who might have wanted to kill Matt, but she couldn't find any answers. She and Matt's parents began to wonder if his new job at Applied Materials could somehow be connected to his murder. The people who worked with Matt, however, didn't think that that was possible. They explained that Matt was still in the early stages of his training and spent most of his time studying manuals and taking orientation tours. He hadn't even started working on anything significant for the company yet. And as you might expect, Matt's new boss offered a different theory. He believed Matt's military service might be connected to his murder. The Mercury News reported that 2 weeks before Matt left the Army, a forester near Fort Stewart discovered a decomposing body in Army fatigues. The remains were later identified as Nicholas Gagne, a sergeant who served under Matt's command. Now, allegedly, Nicholas had disappeared 10 months earlier and was declared AWOL, and this is where things take a massive turn. We're going to take our last break. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. Let's talk more about this military theory. On the morning Nicholas disappeared, two sergeants reportedly saw feet protruding from beneath his bunk, and when they returned with help, his body was gone. A screen had been removed from the barracks window, but Nicholas's wallet and his keys were still in the room. Initially, little concern was raised about his disappearance because he had a history of tardiness and the fact that Matt had recently demoted him for poor performance. So most people just assumed that he had run off, and instead of launching a search for him, officials marked him as AWOL and didn't even notify his family. Fast forward 10 months, and Nicholas was found dead, and according to the Providence Journal, preliminary autopsy findings indicated a skull fracture, but the final report didn't mention that injury at all. Instead, it concluded that his death was caused by blunt force trauma to the chest. His injuries included 10 fractured ribs, a fractured sternum, and 6 fractured vertebrae. The medical examiner noted, quote, "This pattern of injury is consistent with blunt force trauma resulting from a forceful blow to the chest. However, the exact manner of death could not be determined as far as I can tell, and his death remains a mystery to this day." Now, I didn't serve in the military, and I don't know too much about what goes on behind closed doors, but I will say that just hearing about these injuries and hearing about some of the disciplinary actions that had been taken against him prior to his disappearance, it does remind me of the movie Full Metal Jacket. I don't know if any of you have seen it. I'm sure some of you have. It's a pretty popular movie. And they have this thing referred to as a blanket party. And I know it's a real thing in the military. I don't think it happens as much anymore, but it did. And to give you the quick version of it, if they had a soldier who was not complying or who was pissing off the rest of the unit, they would carry out what's called a blanket party. And essentially that entailed catching them in their bed, restraining them, and the rest of the soldiers filling their socks with bars of soap or lox and hitting them multiple times with the socks filled with lox or soap. And obviously, as you can imagine, that's extremely painful. And they did that in this movie, and the movie takes a completely different direction. I won't spoil it for you. But to have these injuries like this, it does look like it could have been a hazing incident gone wrong. And maybe the hazing incident was because Nicholas was not complying and they were trying to send him a message and maybe it went too far. Again, a lot of speculation on my part, but it is something that we have to consider because at this point, as I've mentioned multiple times, we don't know what the motive is and everything is still on the table. And when you think about the fact that Matt was in charge at the time when this happened, it does raise an eyebrow. And what's interesting about the timing is that 2 weeks after Nicholas was found dead, Matt's time in the Army came to an end as planned. This wasn't something that happened because of Nicholas's death. It was already in the works and Matt was discharged and went on with his life. Now, I want to preface everything I'm saying right now. I'm bringing this up because it's information that's out there and I want to be transparent. I'm in no way trying to disparage Matt's character or taint his legacy. This may be a complete coincidence, and there may be nothing nefarious about it at all as it pertains to at least Matt. Nick's death is suspicious. Something went down there. Something happened. The fact that he was last seen in the barracks where Matt was overseeing it, to me, that's a problem, but it doesn't mean that Matt was directly connected. I have no evidence to support that. But we got to bring it up. We got to get uncomfortable, and we got to talk about things that may not always paint our victim in the best light. Does it make me change my opinion of Matt at this point? Absolutely not. But this is an angle we have to explore. And I do want to point out that I did spend some time trying to find out more about Nicholas, although there's not a lot out there. And every time I searched for him, it just came back to Matthew Flores. A lot of you guys are talking about it on the internet and the connection there. And the only thing I did find, which I'll throw up on the screen here, is potentially him from Find a Grave, where it looks like he died in 1994. So it could be the same Nicolas Gagné. I'm not 100% sure, but it appears he had connections. He was originally from Guam, or his family was from Guam. I was trying to see if he had any connections to California. That's what I was really looking to, or something on the West Coast, where if we're going to go down this angle, could someone who is a family member or friend or connected to Nicolas saw this as an opportunity to get back at the person responsible for Nicolas's death? Is that possible? Of course it is. Or is there more to the story where the military is potentially involved and they felt like Matt was a liability? As far as that theory is concerned, we'll get into that in my perspective. But as you can imagine, after the connection between Matt and Nicolas was reported, Denise was asked about Nicolas, and she said that Matt didn't mention his disappearance or his body being found. And that doesn't surprise me as much. I can tell you, as a police officer who hasn't experienced as much death as probably Matt experienced overseas serving our country. But there are things that happen that we don't necessarily tell our significant others. I will say, conversely, this was a fellow soldier living in his barracks that he had command over that he had recently disciplined. You would think at minimum he would say something along the lines of, man, I had an issue with this guy. He disappeared and then he was found dead. I really hope that they figure out what happened here. And I hope that I'm not being considered as a potential suspect. More in that sense, not necessarily, you know, he died and, you know, the specifics of it, but just some mention that, hey, you know, the guy that I was in charge of was found dead and he was basically beaten. Maybe something you would mention, but I don't know, Matt. Maybe he was the type of person who kept everything in house. Now, detectives investigating Matt's murder did explore the possibility that Nicolas's death was somehow related, but a direct connection between the two cases has never been established as far as we know. And I would think at this point, 30 years later, if there was a lead or something that needed to be followed up on, law enforcement would have given an update that may indicate to us that somehow this Ford vehicle was somehow related to Nicolas, and that just is simply not the case. So we have to take it for what it is. They may have limited information, seeing that it involves a U.S. soldier, and with the information they do have, they were never able to connect any dots. That's unfortunately where we are. However, before we move on, I do want to bring up something interesting. When the Mercury News attempted to obtain Matt's military records for their article, the Army responded by saying the files couldn't be located. They said they were unable to determine whether the records had been removed, misplaced, or destroyed, so take that for what you will. So fast forwarding again to 2009, 15 years had passed since Matt's murder, and detectives told the Mercury News that they had spent more time on Matt's case than any other in their department, and recently they brought in consultants to review the case, submitted new evidence to the lab, I don't know what that evidence was, and they also re-examined the surveillance tape. They also revisited Matt's military connections, looking into relationships and assignments that he had during his time serving our country. Despite their efforts, detectives said they couldn't identify any enemies in Matt's life, which led them to seriously consider whether Matt's murder could have been a case of mistaken identity. However, one detective admitted, quote, "There are no facts that can substantiate any theory." Denise also told the Mercury News, quote, "There have been so many days and nights when I've thought of every possible scenario and nothing makes sense." In 2011, Applied Materials reissued their $100,000 reward for information in Matt's case, and detectives shared that Santa Clara County District Attorney's new formed cold case unit had taken on the investigation. They expressed hope, saying, quote, "We are extremely confident that someone somewhere, directly or indirectly, knows something about the killing." At that time, Matt's family issued a public statement which read in part, quote, "We beg you to come forward because we have been living in agony for 17 years and Matthew deserves some justice. We need to know that we can live in a society where this heinous crime is totally unacceptable and that others will be willing to take a stand for justice. There must be someone or various individuals who know exactly what happened." Matt's mother, Ellen, also shared her thoughts with WPRI, which is a news station here in Rhode Island, stating that now she believes Matt was killed by a hitman. However, she did not elaborate on why she held this belief or who might have hired someone to kill her son. The renewed reward and appeal for tips brought in new leads, but none of them provided the breakthrough investigators were hoping for. By March of 2016, 22 years had passed since Matt was executed, and by May of that year, his daughter graduated from college. Around that same time, Applied Materials also once again reissued the $100,000 reward. Detectives told the media, quote, "Matt's friends and families think this case is just as important today as it was more than 20 years ago." They added that they still didn't have enough information to determine whether Matt was the intended target or if he was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. Unfortunately, that's the last update I could find in Matt's case. His murder remains unsolved, and his family is still hoping for that one lead that could crack this case wide open. Okay, let's get into this perspective, and I want to talk about five different theories, some of which I hit on during the episode, and some of them I'll go through quick because I don't think there's a lot of meat on the bone with them. It doesn't mean they're not possible, it's just we don't have a lot of information. So the first one is one we mentioned earlier in the episode, and it's about Matt having something happen while he was in Santa Clara. Although very unlikely, we talked about things involving infidelity, money, road rage, gambling, drinking. It could be as simple as him being out at a bar the night before, getting into an altercation with someone, and that person seeing his vehicle and potentially following him home and maybe following him to work for a couple days and then deciding to retaliate. Again, this is so far-fetched and highly unlikely, but if we find out a year from now that someone just didn't like him and had crossed paths with him very shortly before this incident and decided to kill him because they were not mentally all there and they just thought this was the right thing to do, it would be surprising, but it's not impossible. So even though he was only in California for a very short period of time, the reality is it's still enough time to get into trouble. It could have been something as simply as cutting someone off, which I already mentioned, and them deciding that this was the last time someone was going to quote unquote disrespect them. And it could be gang related where they said, "Oh, this guy flipped me off," or, you know, insulted me or said something to me and I want to get him back. Would be so stupid if that's what this is, but it's possible. It could have happened, and maybe that's why we're unable to solve it. The second theory I want to talk about is that Matt potentially knew something or had information that most people were unaware of. It was something that maybe a group or organization was worried about Matt potentially sharing down the road. So what two angles do we have with that theory? We have the military angle, and I alluded to that when we talked about Nicolas Gagné, where was Matt involved in something during his time in the military that there were higher powers concerned that potentially down the road, Matt could share that information. For example, if Matt wasn't directly involved in Nicolas's death, but knew who was, were there people concerned that because Matt was an upstanding guy, that his conscience may wear on him eventually, and he may decide to come forward, and they wanted to make sure that never happened. That's a possibility. The other angle I looked into briefly was Applied Materials. Obviously, they're going to protect themselves, but I do agree with the sentiment that they put forward. He was there a very short period of time. He was still in the orientation phase. And when I looked up Applied Materials, at least now on their website, they mainly deal in semiconductors, solar displays, and also like rolled out visual displays as well. I don't know what information he would have had working at Applied Materials, even if he had been there for a long time, but maybe there's something we're unaware of that happened inside of there that he witnessed as a new employee, that someone who was there a longer period of time was concerned about him ratting them out. I don't know what that could possibly be, but people have killed for less. So did he witness a theft or something inside the building and someone found out that he knew about it and they decided to take him out before he had a chance to relay that information to anyone? Again, all these theories, possible, how likely? We just don't have the evidence to make that jump, to say this is more likely than the other. The next theory I want to talk about briefly is the idea that someone close to Matt hired a contract killer to kill him. And in those instances, most of the time, it's financially related. And I didn't see anything in my research that said that he had a large life insurance policy or that Denise or anyone else would be entitled to a large sum of money if he passed away. And it seemed like they had a good relationship. Again, I wasn't behind closed doors with him. I don't know what their life was really like. Whenever we tell these stories, it's mostly focused on the positives, but we know that every relationship has its rocky moments, and some of them are pretty bad, and we just don't hear about them. So what was going on internally in his house with Denise, with people close to him, I really don't know. And although on the surface he looked like a great guy from everything that I found, could there be something in his past where he has wronged someone, or without even knowing it, someone found out something that he had done and was clearly upset about it enough to kill him? We can't rule it out because we don't have anything exculpatory in nature to say that's not possible. But I think if there was a large sum of money associated with this, we would know about it. And I also believe that if detectives had spoke to Denise as much as they did, she eventually would have clammed up and said, I'm not getting involved anymore because deep down I know what happened and I don't want to say anything that's going to put them on the right path. So I don't think Denise is a player in this game as far as that's concerned, but could there be another friend or family member that hasn't been mentioned much? Maybe that's what Ellen was alluding to. We may never know. I hope we do, but we may never know. The fourth theory I want to talk about is one that I also mentioned during the episode, and that's the idea that someone has connected Matt to Nicholas Gagné's death, a family member or friend of Nicholas's, and they really didn't care where Matthew Flores was. They knew that they were going after him because they held him responsible for what happened to their loved one. So maybe they're on the West Coast or maybe they're on the East Coast. Doesn't matter. They may have been tracking Matt for a while, and maybe they felt by killing him in California that would throw people off the scent that this was somehow connected to someone who knew Matt and had an axe to grind with him, and they could paint this as some random killing and leave detectives questioning everything, which that's exactly what's going on here. So knowing that Nicholas Gagné was under Matt's command, and Nicholas obviously had friends and family that cared about him, they also have unanswered questions. They also don't know what happened to their son. And they may be perceiving the case as there was this guy named Matthew Flores who was in charge of our loved one. He reprimanded him. Maybe they were hazing him. Maybe there were things that Nicholas conveyed to his family and friends that they didn't like. So when Nicholas went missing and then eventually turned up dead and clearly had been murdered by someone, they're holding the person at the top responsible, that being Matthew Flores. That family of Nicholas Gagné could have hired someone to take out Matthew. That is a theory that when I'm talking about hierarchy of potential scenarios that could come to fruition, that is one that I would put more near the top. It doesn't matter if Matthew was actually involved in Nicholas's death. What does matter is what the people connected to Nicholas believe. Doesn't have to be true. Their perception is their reality. The final theory that I want to talk about, and I talked about it already in the episode, but I just want to drive this point home because I do think, unfortunately, it may be the most plausible scenario, and that's that Matt was the victim of mistaken identity. The vehicle pulling in before him and this Ford Explorer following that vehicle initially says at minimum there's a lack of intelligence gathering. They weren't completely sure what they were looking for. So it's very possible that when they saw Matt's vehicle, they got that wrong as well. And not really seeing Matthew, only seeing him from the backside, they may have shot the wrong guy. And that would be extremely unfortunate to find out that when all of this is said and done, Matthew was killed for no reason at all. He wasn't even the person that was intended to be shot. And that may also be why, as we sit here today, this case has not been solved, because as detectives are trying to find a link, as they're trying to find a motive, they can't, because there isn't any connecting to Matthew. He's not the right person. The person who that bullet was intended for may be still out there walking around. And if that person had been shot, maybe this case would have been solved much easier. But when you have a random killing and the victim may not have even been the intended target, a case that's already difficult or almost becomes impossible to solve. I hope that's not the case, because it does decrease the likelihood of us being able to find out what actually happened. But I'm always going to be honest with you guys. And as I'm sitting here right now, and I'm saying all things are still at play, if you made me choose, this theory would be at the top of the list. But even if that's the case, what this all really boils down to is something I said at the very beginning of this show. There were over 20 people in that parking lot who either saw or heard what happened. And it's very possible that one of them have information that could link to the vehicle, which could then leak to the killer. The problem is getting them to come forward and the barriers to entry associated with having them feel comfortable enough to put themselves out there and risk the safety of themselves and the people they care about. But people change over time, and maybe they initially had things that they were concerned about, maybe young kids or family, whatever it might be. And as life changes, they may be at a position later in life now where they're not as concerned about their safety or the people they care about. And they're just looking for that little nudge to finally come forward and reveal what they know. And I also think it's important to point out that you can remain anonymous. You don't have to put your name, date of birth, and social security number out there. If you want to call and leave an anonymous tip, just by relaying that registration data, even without your personal information, could still lead to this case coming to a resolution. So for that person who may be out there, or for that person who may be in that area, who just needs that little bit of incentive to come forward, you have a family still seeking answers. And if that's not enough, you have a $100,000 reward at play. So just to recap for everyone out there, on the morning of March 24th, 1994, Matthew Flores was killed in the parking lot of Applied Materials in Santa Clara, California. He was shot in the head with a silver-jacketed hollow-point round, and surveillance footage captured a dark Ford Explorer circling the lot before and after the murder, but that vehicle has never been identified. So if you have information about Matt's case, please call Crime Stoppers at 408-947-STOP. As I mentioned multiple times in this episode, there is a reward available. As always, my final words go out to Denise, Danielle, and Ellen. I know some of you are still local, and I hope that I get the opportunity to meet you. If we do run into each other, please say hello. I want you to know that I'm here for you. I know that my listeners and viewers are also here for you as well, and we're all rooting for you and your family and hoping that although it's been too long, you get the answers you deserve, not only for Matt, but for your family and for Danielle, because I'm sure even though she may not remember her dad, she still wonders why this happened and who's responsible, as we all do. So if that update comes, I will be right here to let you guys know. Until then, stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.